Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And welcome to Stage Door Johnny, the podcast about theatre and life in the theatre. How are you doing? Happy New Year. Happy 2024. My goodness me, it's going to be a big year. And welcome to my third season. My third season of Stage Door Johnny. It's so exciting. I've been off doing the day job since we last spoke, but I'm back with a fistful of amazing theatre artists. I've got writers, I've got directors, I've got actors, I've got a theatre critic. Oh yes, never had one of those before, but I think it's good that we disparate folk meet each other. The outlaws should meet the police, a little bit like that scene in Heat, where Al Pacino and Robert De Niro sit across a table from each other in a diner discussing their similarities and their differences. The theatre critic in question is a legend and has amazingly insightful and interesting things to say about the state of theatre in 2024. But I'm going to kick off season three with an absolute corker. Now, this actor has been incandescent on screen in HBO's I May Destroy You, which was written by his great mate from drama school, Michaela Cole. She starred in it, of course. He's been brilliant in Black Mirror, The Lazarus Project, just to prove that he could do anything. He's even done a Richard Curtis movie with Melissa McCarthy. But I'm here to tell you that my guest this week, Papa Esiedu, is one of the best young theatre actors there is, hands down. I went to see him at the National Theatre in a play called The Effect by Lucy Prebble, brilliant Lucy Prebble, directed by Jamie Lloyd, about a man and a woman who meet while taking part in clinical drug trials, and he was so electric that I had to get my family and go back to see it a second time, because it just felt like a huge event. It really did. It felt important. It felt important that they should see it, that we would have that collective memory, one of those nights in the theatre where you feel like, oh, I just want to get all the important people to me to see this. I think he's really special. So just before we all came back to watch the show that evening, Papa was gracious enough to invite me into his his tiny little dressing room at the National Theatre in London. They're all tiny. It's so extraordinary. Oh, and as you'll hear, something life-changing had just happened to him.
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, it's that time again. This is your beginner's call, Mr. Cake and Mr. Esiedu. This is beginners. Beginners, please.
Dude, you're married.
It was great.
Oh, God, amazing. I mean, that is a piece of theatre right there, isn't it? That sense of a public ceremony. Could you mind if I sit in your fridge? I mean, do you want to recline?
Do you mind?
I'm totally fine, because it's basically, if you don't mind me shifting your gear.
What's the best place for me to sit?
Well, do you want to be...
Oh, that's the thing.
Yeah.
I see you. I didn't even see it.
You could be reclining.
Pop open.
Emperor-like. You could crack your first lager of the evening. Papa's just having some water. We need to make it clear.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to make sure that
this is well lubricated. Totally. Did you ever work with anybody who drank during a show?
Obviously, naming no names.
Sure.
I feel like I started when we were on the tail end of that cultural phenomenon, I suppose. And yeah, a couple of my first jobs, in fact, yeah, I'm not going to say where the jobs are because that narrows it down too much. But let's just say maybe one of my jobs in this very building that happened. Because the green room or the blue room, I can't remember which one it is, used to be open during the shows.
Yes.
Right?
It was so, during my day, yeah.
Yeah, so you could literally like come off stage, go have a cigarette, have a half pint, come back and then be ready for act two. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think there's anything, have you ever been curious about it? Have you ever had to do like one of those rehearsal things where you're doing a check-off where everyone's drinking vodka and you've tried it?
I've not done that, but I remember when I was in my final year of drama school, at the end of your 3 years, you have to do this kind of showcase thing where everyone does a speech in front of all the casting directors and the agents who can be bothered to come to a drama school on a Tuesday afternoon. And it really felt like this was, you know, a make or break moment. This is...
Yeah, I remember it so well.
It's awful.
I'm getting nervous. Just you talking.
Genuinely hives are like...
Awful.
But I remember like that was one of the only times that me and my friend, we were doing it at the Fortune Theatre around the corner from here, across the river from here. And there's a little Sam Smith's pub around the corner from there. And in between like our final warm up and... curtain up, we were just like, fuck it, I had a pint and a chaser.
Did you?
In what, 120 seconds or something? So like that really hits different, you know. And it did actually get, and because the speech that I had chosen was quite high octane or whatever, it did like give me like a little something. But my other friend who also did it, he went too far.
He got his dosage wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. We should have been microdosing instead of macrodosing, let's say. But look, I'm not like a prude about these things and, you know, like, but for me, like the temptation to become reliant on it is not something that I would want to be beholden to.
We were going to get onto this. I was going to get onto this in a bit, working with Tony Scher on King Lear, which you did, right, at the RSC. Yeah. And Tony, when I went to the RSC, when I just left drama school, Tony was, obviously one of the stars of the company, and he played Tamburlaine. I was in the production of Tamburlaine. And I didn't know, because I am still and have always been so square, that he was chopping up big fat lines of coke, which he'd started doing. I think he wrote about it. You know, it's all out there in the public record, which I think he'd started doing, you know, when he did that famous Richard III on crutches. And it was just that thing of like, I'm down. I need something. I don't know who might have suggested it or whether it was his own idea, but he had a bit of a bump of that. And then suddenly you start, you know, like actors are creatures of ritual, creatures of superstition. You know, we want to make sure that we're in the best possible state. Yeah. And if something gives you that amazing lift one night.
Do you remember it retrospectively? Do you remember like a kind of like frenzied energy or?
Do you know what I have to say? I do. It seemed pretty indivisible from... Tamburlaine, I don't know if you know, it was a Christopher Marlowe play. This Scythian shepherd rises from nothing, a sort of Genghis Khan figure, to rule the world. And he goes from one bloody massacre of some other state to another until he sort of conquered everything. And so there was a real front foot warrior energy to what Tony did. And he was always such a physical actor and so sort of naturally energized anyway. But there was one time, I've said this before, I think on the podcast, who was I talking to about it? I can't remember, where we had to carry him on his shoulders. A diminutive man, Tony, wasn't a tall man, which is brilliant for this all-conquering guy with that stature, but he was puffed out and built in those days. And he was on our shoulders for this great scene where he's sort of seducing this other Asian leader, and he fell and smashed onto the floor of the Swan Theatre in Stratford. You know, it was clearly a mistake. He got up and gave this sort of 5-page speech of seduction, essentially, to this actor called Jack Claff, and it was some of the best acting I've ever seen in my life. And you thought, actually, there's some breakthrough here. You don't need this great physical grandstanding to do this part superbly. It's all there in relationships. And actually what happened was
perhaps without the coke, this is a fanciful thing to say, but perhaps he might have felt that too and not felt like he needed to rehearse us twice as long the next day, not falling off his shoulders again. There was something quite clenched about what that thing had to be. Does that make sense?
It is interesting what you say about us being like creatures of habit, especially within the theatre. Yeah. I suppose it's something that's connected with the thing of doing the same thing every day, eight times. And also like the intangible of when it works and when it doesn't. It always feels just like, it feels like trying to hold on to water, like trying to make it good. And I think anything that kind of like leans too much into being effortful and trying to make something good is ultimately impossible, you know? So I think like as a means of trying to combat the chaos of it or the intangibility of the moment, that's where these kind of superstitions are. Because I'm not like generally a superstitious person, but I've got like various things that like I don't even notice that I do, but I have to do it every single day in the same order.
Really?
In the same order, yeah.
Like?
I don't get into my costume until after Beginners.
Until after Beginners?
After Beginners. That's when I get into my costume.
For anybody who doesn't know, Beginners is like you're five, essentially, you're on stage in 5 minutes. It's happening.
Yeah,
right
but
now.
Beginners is like, you need
beginners,
to
you gotta
leave
go.
Your dressing room.
Yeah, they're like,
now.
Please come to the stage now.
And it's been preceded by a half an hour call, a 15 minute call, and a 5 minute call.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To tell you, you should be getting ready, you should be getting ready. And I cannot get into costume before Beginners. And I don't know what that is. I've actually been like that really since. I think Hamlet, but I don't like being in costume and not doing it.
How fascinating.
I feel like that's kind of like the last piece of armor you kind of put on. Huh. So I try to do that as late as possible.
Do you think it's got anything to do with wanting to keep yourself before you get dressed in the uniform of the play as available to being on stage as possible? So there's a thinner gap as possible between you and it?
Yeah, I mean, I wish it was something as professional as that, but like, I think it's just that it's not habit, but I've been doing that, so I don't want to see what happens if I don't do it.
Right.
I feel like we're kind of beholden to the fear of it all going wrong.
Yeah.
The fear of the wheels all coming off if we change one thing.
Yeah.
Remarkably. But I suppose like that is also something that when you're doing a play, you have to constantly be, challenging, you know, like you've got to be challenging this like urge to do it the same as how it went yesterday that line that got a laugh yesterday in exactly the same way. Or you've got to, no matter how safe it feels or how calming it feels, that's what you've got to play against, I feel. So the hypocrisy of my clothing regime is very clear to me, but who knows, maybe tonight I'll...
Is it avoidance? Do you want to put it off as long as possible?
To be fair, I think it is. I also, this particular costume... me and Taylor Russell, who plays Connie in the play, we're wearing thick tracksuits.
Yes.
And we've been mostly doing this play in the heat of summer.
Sure.
Right? So shout out the costume and wardrobe department of the National Theatre, because it's a state by the end of this play. And they've got to deal with things that no person deserves to have to deal with. So for me, like that kind of half an hour period before the play starts is all about like relaxation, calming, slowing down, like rhythm and heart rate and breathing and everything. So I think it's probably intertwined with that kind of preparation.
And that doesn't get undone when you're potentially late for...
Well, I'm never late.
You're never late. Always get the costume on it.
Yeah. I put it on quickly. I don't take my time,
right.
But...
Right.
I just don't start until...
A restoration company or something. You've got to get into a rough.
Yeah, exactly. A rough.
Massive.
Makeup.
Bridges.
All the rest. I'd probably still try it.
Adjusting your codpiece just before going on. Yeah. It's such an interesting thing, people's rituals. And where are you, that thing of keeping it alive, not chasing what happened last night? What does Mark Rylance call it? He says... No audience wants last night's leftovers. They want everything to be fresh. Of course, that's the perfect state we're all chasing. Where are you with this show, The Effect, right now?
We've got two more weeks after tomorrow. We've had, I think, a 9-week run. 10-week run. So we're in the trenches of it, you know, we're deep in.
Yeah.
And
how's your body?
My body's all right, actually. It's a very physical show for me, particularly, but my physical routine kind of daily builds up to that kind of 7:30 till 9:28 kind of period, you know? So like I'm conditioned fairly well in terms of the protection and the regeneration of spontaneity in the show. That's been built into it from the beginning. So like, the way Jamie Lloyd, our director, works, he's quite autocratic in his resistance of blocking and staging and setting things in stone. He's like very, 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 very anti that, in a way that can be in equal parts freeing and infuriating, you know, or like terrifying. But I think it works really well for this play. There are vast swathes of the play which are just like free, particularly physically, also kind of in terms of like the peaks and troughs of it. We've got things that we're aiming to, like, I suppose, destinations that we're aiming to reach, but the journey we take to get there has got a myriad of different paths and routes. So that aids this pursuit of spontaneity. Yeah. And Mark's definitely right to say that no one wants... It's really about having the respect for the audience that's put in front of you, you know, because, like, often the audience has never seen it before. Maybe so if it's all right, maybe some people have come once or twice before, but people have got the right to be able to experience what you're doing as if for the first time.
Totally.
You know, and...
But that's even so much easier said than done. Do you ever find yourself that little outside eye that we sometimes... You know, we wish we didn't have, but I find particularly quite hard to turn off when I'm doing a show. You're both in it and sort of weirdly outside it sometimes.
100%, yeah.
Do you ever catch yourself echoing things you've done before?
I think on the days when I'm least connected, that's when that happens. I think it's a kind of defense mechanism, or it's the autopilot, you know, or it's the anxious mind. Because, for example, last night, without being... too self-involved, like, I would say that I didn't have one of my best shows. And it's because, like, just before the show, someone that I knew said that a certain director was watching the show. And that completely spins me out, you know, because whether you know where they're sitting or who they are, whether you can't help but have that as, like, a headline in your frontal lobe. The pressure is on to be good, to do it right, to do it the best it's ever been, which completely like takes the scaffolding and structure of everything shit. Whereas like the moments where you're like, I don't know if anybody's in at all, or I can't see anyone, or I don't care if anyone, that allows you to really connect to what you're doing and who you're with. For me, that is the most rich kind of petri dish for new things being born. So now, like, I've told people to not tell me they're coming, apart from you, not tell me they're coming until 7:29, which hopefully I've put my costume on.
To notice that text coming through. I'm here. Exactly. See you later. So if we all have that crazy self-consciousness, of course, because it's antithetical, right, to what we're trying to do, which is there's no one watching. These are real people in a space, and it's not being witnessed. However artificial that really is, we'd love to. That's the perfect state, isn't it? That we are just here being observed, and we don't have any relationship to the observers. Though, interestingly, I wanted to talk to you about that with soliloquies when it comes to talking directly to the audience, if that's indeed what a soliloquy is. But we can get onto that. So how are you with like press nights, that weird thing that we have in England where in America, you know, the press dribble in over the course of a sort of week, and you generally get an idea when the New York Times, the most sort of, you know, impactful one, is in. That sort of just vibrationally in the theatre, you can't avoid it. But how are you with that one-off crazy night where it's all been set up for that illusion that you're just doing the play for each other to be so overtly shattered?
I genuinely think that's like that's a lifetime's work, and that's a it's because I remember the first time I ever did a play and there was a press night, I could not believe how stressed everybody was. and how suppressed that anxiety was. No, everyone kind of like does a relatively bad job actually of pretending that it's all fine and it's just same as every other night or whatever, but like feverishly writing cards to each other, which is actually the most stressful bit of the first night, I think, like trying to make sure you don't forget to write a card to, you know, someone in the sound department or whatever. Thank you for reminding me. Look, on this job, like Jamie was always, the kind of mantra was, you're not in a play. This is not a play. You're not doing a play. So it's not about like acting, or it's not about like trying to elicit response from the audience. And that is certainly not about trying to get reviewed well. He's publicly like very kind of like shunning of reviews and tries to allow the work to exist independently of whatever that kind of feedback system is. You're totally right in the fact that it's antithetical. The structure of how plays or the process is in the fact that you have previews where during the preview period you're literally coming in to work every day and changing it and finessing it and tweaking it, and then after the press night you're not doing that anymore, and there's this kind of like handing over from like director being in charge of the process to, in a way, the actors being in charge. But like I still try to think of it as more of a friends and family evening as opposed to a press night,
right.
You know, because there's something beautiful about that. There's something really, really energizing and exciting about being able to share something that you've been working on for whatever it is, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, with people that you know, respect, love, and who you know are there to support you and to lift you up and to say well done or to commune with you afterwards, you know, to be honest with you, in a way that you just will never be able to calmly do that if you've got, like, you know, the Guardian critic in your mind's eye or the Independent or whatever.
The reason I'm laughing is I was just reminded, I haven't thought of this in how many years. I did Coriolanus at the Globe just along the South Bank here in, I don't even remember, 2008 or something. And my mum and dad, I suddenly, you know, because it's sort of partially in daylight, and it was a time of year, I think you could still see people in the audience. I saw my mum and dad at the curtain call sitting right directly in front of me. I was so off my tits on sort of adrenaline and the excitement of having just completed this thing. And actually, it was a press night. I remember that. It was a press night where I felt like I found new, fresh stuff. And I felt like I'd sort of outwitted that awful curse of self-consciousness and feeling like, you know, you're being watched and judged. I saw them and I blew them a kiss. And only later did I realize Michael Billington was sitting right in front of them.
I hope he's got a 5-star rating.
It must have looked like I was going, there, Michael. Here's my kiss to you. All right. So your body's all right. And, you know, you're very aware of how to cope with that lifelong struggle of how to keep things fresh and how to deal with press nights. How's your heart and mind dealing with this stage of this play, 7 weeks into a 9-week run? How's that doing?
It's interesting. Like I've got a thing where, because I've really enjoyed this particular process, and being honest, I wouldn't say that about every play that I've ever done. I wouldn't say which ones I haven't, but like not all of them, but I've really, really, really loved this. I feel like as a community, by that I mean both the onstage and offstage cast and the creative, blah, 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 we've created something like unique and genuine and honest between us, which is good. But like I do have a thing where like my brain starts reaching the end of a run, just starts deleting. I once did a production of A School for Scandal, or The School for Scandal, I can't remember what it's called. But I remember we were doing the final show, and my brain started deleting lines as we were doing it. Suddenly I'd never like forgotten a line, messed up a line, the entire run, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly like things were completely going. I didn't know where I was, didn't know where to come on from. Because my brain was like, this is no longer useful information for me. I'd rather be thinking about what the Man United score was, etc. And I do think my brain and body, and I suppose my heart and mind kind of like prepares in that way for the ending of a show. So with this one, it's really important that I don't start deleting, because the intimacy and the, I suppose the frisson is so tightly wound within it. Like, as soon as like bits kind of start, bits of DNA start like disappearing, it's going to have a big impact. So I'm actually now at the stage where I have to kind of like read the play every day and like go through my lines every day.
Wow.
Which you'd think I'd be doing more towards the beginning of the run, but I actually have to do it more at this point because my brain's starting to be like, if you let me let it go, I'll let it go. You know,
it's like sort of separation anxiety.
It's definitely,
it's like, I can't, you're going to get hurt leaving it. So I'm going to leave you first.
Exactly. I can't bear to grieve the loss of it, mourn the loss of it. So, therefore, I need to get ahead of it. I don't need you anyway, kind of thing.
That is so fascinating. And we're here in your dressing room, your palatial dressing room at the National Theatre. And I'm reading about you, which is always such a privilege doing this, you know. Talking to these amazing theatre artists and having a little time to delve back into your life, I know it's a very superficial version of it, whatever appears in the press and whatever interviews you've given and stuff like that, but it's always very, I always find it very thrilling, you know, getting a sort of overview of someone that you wouldn't necessarily do. You might cast a glance in the programme and go, oh, look, he did that with that person. Interesting. But to sit there, you know, for a week beforehand, just reading about you, you know, sort of immersing myself in your life in the theatre, is I always find it so, well, very inspiring, actually. I just sort of feel like, look at the work that's gone in. Look at the breadth and depth of the experience, you know. So one of the things that, of course, comes up about the legend of Papa is here at the National Theatre, Linda, who we briefly referred to earlier that you didn't write a card to on the first night, who's the legendary stage door keeper at the National Theatre, was talking about you doing that 10 years ago in Sam Mendes' production of King Lear. Are you very bored of talking about this, by the way?
Yeah, no. Because it often comes up. I can't talk about it. Right?
So 10 years ago, Simon Russell Beale did Lear for Sam Mendes. And you were understudying Edmund, Jamie Troughton. You're not long out of
Sam Troughton. Yeah.
Sam Troughton, forgive me. Yeah. Sam Troughton. Does he have a brother called Jamie Troughton? I think he does. Who used to play cricket?
Yeah, Wigsy, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. You were not long out of Guildhall, I think, where you trained, and you came here to do that. And do you want to tell this story, or shall I pray see it how I've understood it? What would you prefer?
Maybe I'll tell it, because to be honest, I don't know how it came out in
right.
articles or whatever. Right. But like the way it worked was, so we were doing a big Shakespeare, we were doing King Lear, a dream job to get a couple of years out of drama school. And the thing that really made me want to do it was just being surrounded by who I thought were like the best actors in the country. It was Simon Russell Beale playing King Lear, Adrian Scarborough playing The Fool, Kate Fleetwood playing Goneril, Adam Maxwell Martin playing Regan, Sam Troughton playing Edmund, Tom Brooke playing Edgar, list goes on. So like every single, and I was playing the Duke of Buckingham, who has got like maybe four lines in the first scene. And then for the rest of the play, I was kind of like walking around like, picking up chairs, putting down chairs, like rowdy nights, etc. It is what it is, but I actually loved it because every single day was an absolute like school day, you know, like watching people, watching their processes and watching their brilliance, basically. So I had spent the whole rehearsal really kind of like watching people, especially Sam. I'd been like going into his rehearsals, watching his scenes and blah, 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 and like taking notes and like just doing that kind of thing that a very keen, a freshly graduated drum student would do. Anyway, we get into the run. It's all going well. It's the night before press night, I think, or maybe two nights before press night. And in one of the early scenes, Sam, who is famous for having like an incredibly strong voice and, you know, like had done many, many plays at National Theatre, could like bounce off the back of the Olivier back wall with ease, you know. And he's doing this scene. I'm backstage, like getting changed to become knight number 18 or whatever. And then suddenly, like, he's literally talking at this level. Then you can't hear anything at all. So, like, if I don't know if you remember, but in the wings of the Olivier stage, there's often a black and white kind of like TV screen that shows you what's happening on stage. which is kind of like infrared, so that if you're like moving stuff in the dark, you can see it. And I could see that Sam was still on stage and was still or his mouth was still moving, but there weren't any sounds coming out. There's a lot of gesticulating, pointing. He's doing a duologue scene with Stanley Townsend, who's playing Kent, I think. Yeah. And basically Stanley starts like asking and answering his own questions, basically. So it's like a two-person scene with all the lines coming out of one mouth, basically. Sam's doing a lot of nodding and pointing and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so like backstage, it's all very exciting. We're like, wow, like what's going to happen? And it very, very, very slowly dawns on me, like a bucket of cold ice being poured over your head, that, oh, I'm the person who's going to have to somehow wade in and intervene with this issue. And the way it works at the National Theatre, or at least it did then, is the understudies didn't get any rehearsals at all.
Yeah, that's until so surprising
after
to me.
The press night, which is totally bananas to
yeah.
me. Well, so we hadn't had any rehearsals either.
Oh my God.
So like my only understanding of the part was what I had gleaned from going to watch the rehearsals, which most people don't do. But because I was like such a keen bean, I had been doing. Sam Mendes comes like huffing and puffing backstage. Red is beach red. And he's like, Sam's clearly lost his voice, so you're going to have to go on. Do you want to go on with the book? And I say, Sam, don't worry, I've got it. I'm not going to go on with the book. I can't even remember how old I was at this time, but definitely not old enough to be talking with that level of confidence. So I say, I'm not going to go on with the book. I'm getting fitted for Sam's costume backstage. And for some reason, his costume was modelled on a Nazi like SS officer, which was kind of bizarre, being fitted with these like knee-high boots and whatever. And then we muddle our way through to the interval, and after the interval, Sam comes on stage and Sam says to the audience, today you're going to have seen two actors' worst nightmares. One is losing your voice in front of 1,200 people in the middle of a show, and the other is an understudy having to go on with no rehearsal. Please, 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 please be supportive. Audience all rise to the feet, they applause, blah, blah, blah. We go into the second half. The first scene that I have is with Goneril, played by Kate Fleetwood, as I just said. And that scene ends with the line, oh, the difference between man and man. Biggest laugh Kate has ever got in her career. And she says to herself, you know. And yeah, it kind of was like this kind of out-of-body experience, all kind of happening in like slow motion and hyperspeed at the same time. And we kind of, yeah, get through to the end of the show. And I guess, yeah, because it was in that kind of like press week, it so happened that like Mark Lawson was in the audience, so-and-so was in the audience, and it became a little bit of a talking point for a few days. And
He said it was like having a star player sent off and you still go on and win the game. Because it's an emergency, right? We'll get on to talking about the effect or what, you know, my experience of it was, and I'd love to talk more about that. But I thought, hearing you talk about Jamie Lloyd not setting any of the blocking and the freedom of that, there is an extraordinary sense of just thrilling excitement about this show that you're doing right now. Was there any of that feeling of the excitement of an emergency for you going on, or was it just stone cold terror?
Both. And also, I guess, like, that is the unique position of being an understudy, right? And I've done it, you know, like I've been understudy like a few times in the earliest stages of my career. It's like you both want to go on desperately so that you can prove what you can do, and don't want to go on at all because it's terrifying. You think everyone's going to be infuriated to even see your face. You haven't had the rehearsal, like, blah, blah. It's quantum in how extreme it is in both directions. Yeah. So it was both like absolutely thrilling and the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me. And also I wanted to like disappear into a gap between the floorboards and never like rise up again, you know? So it's a bizarre position to be put in, to be an understudy. And I think understudies are some of the bravest actors, there are out there, you know, because it's kind of like, I suppose being a goalkeeper in football or like a youth player on the bench, like you've got to like retain that level of concentration for so long with no promise of it definitely having to be used. And that takes a huge amount of energy, you know. It's actually easier in many ways to know that you're going to go on, and you have to do the speeches and you have to, like, you know, that at least you've got like a sense of certainty around it. So I've got nothing but very deep, deep, deep respect for understudies all over the country that are really the structures that uphold the theatrical productions that we know and love.
Yeah. But here you are, 10 years later, in this palatial dressing room.
Here I am.
Playing the lead in this electric play at the same place. I hope this doesn't sound too sort of glib or small, but that must feel like something. You said something, quoting people's fucking interviews back about this, something that might feel really objectionable to you. You did say, and tell me if this is a pointless avenue to go down. You said to be back at the National Theatre nearly 10 years later in a very different position in the pecking order feels like one of the rare moments of validation in this industry. He says, it's you. You've got to grab them. And I normally spend so much time having self-doubt or self-flagellating. So I was just wondering, how is the self-doubt at the moment?
I think it's in a healthy place at the moment, you know. Like the self-doubt allows me to have a sense of objectivity or at least like an eye on where I can improve or kind of keep pushing myself forward as we go on this. What is a 9-week run? It's like very different from doing like television or film where it's about like being on point for that scene, that day, and then it's done. You never do it again. You know, like being able to like allow a character and a story and an arc to grow both over the course of a show, but also over the course of a run is a very different skill set. So self-doubt's in a good place. In terms of like the 10 years later thing and the different pecking order, I suppose it speaks to what you were saying about like looking back over someone's body of work and seeing that it's not immediate. Sometimes you talk to students, or I look back to myself when I was coming out of drama school, and like you think about like, yeah, I want to be at National right now, and I want to be playing leads, and I want to be getting 5-star reviews and blah, 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 blah. I wasn't ready to do that. You know, I didn't have the experience. I didn't have the skill set, and I just didn't have the breadth of internal and external knowledge to be able to do it in the way that I do now. Right now, I do feel ready to be doing what I'm doing, and I feel confident and I feel excited, and I can still feel the potential for more. Whereas like, I know for a fact that if I was doing exactly the same thing 10 years ago, the self-doubt, that noise would be so much louder, that voice would be so much bigger and potentially overwhelming, you know? So I think the way my career has worked, at least, it's been like a gradual step-by-step process, hopefully like mostly moving forwards. And many times there's been the question of, can I do this or can I not do this? But like, it's always, for me, felt within the realm of possibility. I felt like I probably can do this if I really, really, really put my mind to it.
You said that the self-doubt helps you be objective, helps you with a sense of objectivity. You said you didn't feel like you had one of your strongest nights last night. How do you know? And do you feel confident do you feel confident knowing that you weren't where you wanted to be? Because often, you know, you must have had this experience too, where people you really trust, even maybe the director, when you feel like you've been weaker, one of the things I find very difficult about the job we do is how little real objectivity is possible. And how much, which is of course why the director was invented in the first place, how much an outside eye is so crucial. But do you really feel like you're certain last night wasn't up to your standard?
What I do know is it kind of doesn't matter. In fact, it definitely doesn't matter what I think, because number one, it's not a one-person show. It's not just me.
Sure.
So therefore, the responsibility is not on me to make the play good. There's many, many, many other people involved in the execution of it.
who contribute in a huge way to making that happen. Also, in terms of like whether like I'm good or not, or whether people like it or not, again, it doesn't really matter what I think. If like someone else says that,
right?
How they received it was the thing, because again, that's what people are paying the money for, and like this process is symbiotic. It's about me putting something out and someone receiving something and giving it back and so on and so on. So it doesn't matter. But what is, I think, important, and I think is important for an actor within a run, is to be constantly checking in on yourself, yeah, in terms of how successful you are in achieving what you're setting out to do. For me, when I say that I didn't feel I had one of my strongest nights, it wasn't because I was like, oh, I didn't get the biggest laugh or I didn't get tears out or whatever. It was more to do with my sense of like connection to what I was doing, my sense of spontaneity with what I was doing, and like my where my concentration lay. Like I said, I was so kind of like swung out by thinking about like who was in the audience. Oh, yeah. It made me unable to be fully present with what was happening in the moment and who I was with. That's what I'm talking about,
right,
really.
Right.
And I think you can be objective about that. Yeah, you can, or at least you can kind of like measure how connected you feel to the people that you're around.
Yeah.
So as long as there's like a cleanness about like what your objective is, if it is about like getting, you know, the biggest like standing ovation or whatever, yeah, then like there is no objectivity,
right,
and like it's elusive and impossible. But like I do think that my only real intention is to be as connected to Taylor, to Michelle, to Cobner, and to Lucy Prebble as possible for as many seconds within the like about 1 hour and 44 minutes of the play as possible. And for me, the moments when I'm most successful is when like that portion of the play where I feel connected is as high as possible.
Yeah. So there's no reset today. Just to articulate that, is that enough for you? You know, you're not going to consciously do anything else. You just realize what was going on last night.
Yeah.
And tonight's a different night, and yeah, you don't know where that's going to go. But just to remind yourself that being, yeah, distracted by being talking about who's in,
yeah,
obviously it's going to be a huge night because it's me and my,
exactly,
wife,
kids
yeah, massively critical. Yeah, yeah, it's going to be tough.
Move over, Michael Billings.
Blow him a kiss afterwards. listen, we've got to be really conscious. Look at that. We've got no more time. A little bit more time, but not enough. But that's all right. Do you remember the first time you were on stage? Was theatre part of your growing up, by the way? Did you go
really?
See?
No, I never stopped. I didn't go to the theatre for the first time until I was 17, probably.
17?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Wow. But weren't you in the National Youth Theatre?
When I was 18.
Oh, okay. What was the show when you were 17?
I think it was Accidental Death of an Anarchist.
Ah.
I think that was the first play I saw, which is a bizarre play to watch when you've never seen a play before.
What was the context? School trip?
Your school trip. It was at the Hackney Empire, actually. Right. Didn't understand it and didn't love that. But then the second play that I saw, the second play that I saw was Othello at the Donmar Warehouse with Chiwetel Ejiofor and Ewan McGregor,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
Tom Hiddleston. And I loved that. I loved it. And it was really, like, I suppose like Shakespeare being performed was my kind of way into loving theatre, to be honest, because I hated Shakespeare at school and it's so boring, the kind of like Romeo and Juliet, to what extent do opposites attract, blah, blah, all that stuff. Where I was like, I found it completely impenetrable, but like there was something about like speaking the words and seeing the words spoken and seeing the kind of like the space that they occupy in between the emotional, the physical, the psychological, the mental, seeing that kind of like suddenly like come to life and be something other than like a very, very tedious excavation in an English classroom provided a pathway into me.
There was something, obviously, between not really connecting with Accidental Death of an Anarchist to applying for NYT.
Yeah.
How did you know about NYT?
I knew about NYT because there's a girl that was going to NYT who I had a situation with, and it sounded like a laugh. Like, you know, I like with NYT at that time, you got to stay in halls of residence. I grew up in London, but you got to stay in halls of residence with a bunch of like other like-minded, like aged
the
people.
The ones in Hampstead.
Was in there's one in Holloway Road, but was in Laban in Greenwich.
Okay, wow.
Which was like a whole part of London I'd never been to before. And yeah, it was like, what, you get to play drama games all day, every day. So I was like, and it was quite funny because you had to pay to do it. You had to pay for the residence and you had to pay for the course.
Did you?
Yeah, and I had to, I didn't have much money at that time. So I had to raise money to go. And I remember I raised money by doing an assembly at my school and charging people to come to, it was basically an evening with Paparazziadu, which was, I imagine underwhelming to say the least, but like I basically did my like drama school speeches and a couple of songs as well.
I charged them.
I charged people £4 each. So it worked.
People came.
Yeah, I think my social capital like plummeted quite significantly after that.
And do you remember it fondly? Was it a good summer?
National Youth
Theatre. Yeah, NYT.
Yeah, I loved it. I really loved it because that was the first time I'd been around people who were interested in like seeing this pathway of storytelling more so than like, oh, I'm around actors, but around people who are interested in directing and people who are interested in stage management and people who are interested in filmmaking and et cetera. I didn't have any kind of availability to that before that point, and I just found it thrilling, and it was also people of different ages, like from 16 to like 23 or something like that, and it was honestly wonderful. So it was from there that I kind of found out that you could go to drama school, because I didn't know what a drama school was at that point, but people that were applying to drama school, so then I did that, and then I ended up going to drama school, and that's when it kind of all blew up for me in terms of like my understanding and love of theatre, because I am a real theatre file, as it were. I see a lot of plays and I love watching things live and direct. I love seeing the blood, the sweat, the tears, all of that. Yeah, I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, I don't like plays. I absolutely love plays.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. That's why I do this podcast, because I feel the same way. I feel like it's sort of magical every time. The lights go down and the stage lights come up. Yeah. I can't believe it's people are doing this.
Yeah.
It's such an extraordinary thing, isn't it? It's like a caveman standing up to sort of talk about first killing of a mammoth or something. You're like, I can't, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Right there. I can see you right it's there in front
the,
of me.
You're in the room with it, which I think is like a great privilege.
Yeah.
To be able to like, you see someone like be vulnerable or be exuberant. I get it from live theatre. I get it from live music. I get it from live sport. Like there's something about watching people like strive for virtuosity, which I just love.
And it's a story, isn't it? From beginning to end, it's you're seeing, you're not breaking the bits up in chunks like we do when we film. You know, that thing of just, you're tracking the thing in real time in front of you. From a beginning where you know nothing to the end where you hopefully know
something.
Something. Can I just quickly tell you about this play at the moment that you're doing? I just thought I was so blown away by watching it. Perhaps I shouldn't say too much because you've got to go do it. And that's a weird thing that might make you feel self-conscious. But I'm just going to say this. I was just interviewing our mutual friend Simon Godwin for this podcast, who directed you as your Hamlet, which we haven't talked about. And I was saying that I'd just seen you for the first time in this play, The Effect. And I said that when I was living in New York, I went to see Mark Rylance do a play called La Bette. Did you see it?
That's what I hear.
Do you remember the incredible first half of
amazing.
It?
Amazing.
It's just a monologue, 30 right?
minutes or whatever.
Yeah. He just talks.
Yeah.
And a friend I was with knew this theatre and film director called Mike Nichols. Do you know Mike Nichols? So I got introduced to Mike Nichols.
Mike didn't direct.
He was just in the audience. It was press like.
Oh, I see.
He actually produced something that I was in later on, but I didn't know him at the time. And he said, about Mark, he said, it's streetcar time. And what he meant by that was he was at the first night of Brando's Streetcar, if you can believe it. And every time he saw something really, really special, he'd say, it's streetcar time.
Wow.
And I was like, mate. I said to Simon, it's streetcar time.
Wow.
I'm serious. So let's quickly talk about that. The chemistry between you and Taylor is insane. And that word chemistry is such a weird thing. You know, is it something that is entirely accidental, do you think, on stage, the connections between people? Is it something that can be faked? Do you have any prescription or advice, or how do people keep that thing?
I mean, it's a really good question, isn't it? Because, like, I don't think it can be faked.
Right.
Do you?
No, I don't. You must have had those times, we don't have to name names, but have you ever had those times when it just isn't there?
I'd say 80% of the times that I have got to do anything that's kind of like similar to what me and Taylor are doing. Maybe not like completely like dead, but like definitely. I think with Taylor, I feel very fortunate to be like met by someone who is just like incredibly brave, available, open, and with great integrity. You know, so like I don't know if it's helped by the fact that she's never done a play before.
It's her first time on stage. It's completely insane.
Literally her first time in front of any audience at all, including school plays.
I don't understand how she does that.
Any audience was on the Littleton stage on the 1st of August in front of 900 people. So, like, you're talking about an incredibly courageous... And it's hard to explain because, like, yeah, I could say, yeah, we get on and we're mates and blah, blah, blah. But, like... There is something very delicate about what we're and fragile about what we're trying to create and sustain in this show. And I think it requires like an infinite trust between us. So like, I think mostly it's been about that. We spent a lot of time talking, mostly not about the play, mostly about like, other things. And a lot of time kind of like, physically, I suppose, like getting to know each other in a very safe way, but like in a way that kind of allows like our boundaries to be as porous and permeable as possible, which helps with this show. And there's also real clarity as to the parameters of our relationship, because I think that's another thing that can be really difficult when you're doing these kind of things. It's like you're kind of like, is this real or is it not real? Or do they think I'm trying to say this about them? Or are they looking at me like that? That is, I think, the thing that is most difficult to circumnavigate in those kind of relationships. But with our relationships, very, very, very clear. We're very, very, very comfortable and I suppose, yeah, open and front footed in terms of like what we want from each other, which is really beautiful. And yeah, so I feel incredibly lucky and I can't really imagine doing it with anybody else.
It's so exciting to watch you two together. It's so exciting. It really is. It's properly like, I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea what either of you are going to do. No idea where this story is going. It just feels so alive in the most beautiful, pure way. I often find with people you're supposed to have this relationship with, that actually it's much easier. Of course, the ideal is that if you really admire them and you really, you know, you obviously like you do with Taylor, you have that connection to them. I find indifference is a disaster, but I find if you really dislike somebody,
it could also be quite good.
Weirdly, it could also be quite quite powerful.
It's kind of in the existence, unfortunately exists in the same space, doesn't it?
all right, my last question. What pisses you off about the theatre?
Ooh, I guess like lack of ambition. What do I mean by that? Obviously, like with theatre, it's an imperfect economic model, right? It's like quite expensive to make it happen. And as such, like we can be slaves to what we know will work. But like all the best plays that I've ever seen have been radical in some way. You know, I'm like, we're talking about Mark Rylance, right? So let's talk about like Jerusalem. The first time I saw Jerusalem, right? And I had an idea of what kind of actor Mark was. And I've got a lot of friends who are from, in fact, like my partner's from the West Country, but I've got a lot of friends from the West Country. So I spend time in like those parties, basically.
Flintock.
Yeah. You know, like Western and... But I just found like the original production, which obviously kind of like got remounted to an extent this year or last year to great success, was like there was a radicalness about like the transformation that he went through for that. You know, both like physically, like it looked like he'd like doubled in size, you know, and then vocally, and all of that, you know, like there was something, and that could really, really not have worked. You know, it could really, really have gone wrong.
Yeah.
And it went all right. So like, I kind of feel like anything that kind of like leans into the danger or the potential of it going wrong, or anything that exists in the space between winning and losing, I think is worth doing. And that to me is like spontaneous. So in a mirror to what we were talking about of this like chasing of like the intangible and like the hallowed space in theatre where you can't kind of prepare for it, I kind of think that feeds through the DNA of all kind of theatre making, programming, direction, performance. So anything that kind of leans in the opposite direction to that kind of is spin off.
Love it. Mate, I'm so excited to see this play again tonight. I really am.
I hope after all that you still like it.
It's an absolute disaster. Thank you so much for giving me the time, particularly before the show. Thank you so much. And thank you for your performance, because it is Streetcar Time.
Oh, thank you.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
All right, there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Papa Essiadu, everybody. So thoughtful, so open, so incredibly generous with his time. Thank you, Papa. And thank you also to Rosina and Jessica at Tapestry for helping me to set it up, arrange it, and all the staff at the National Theatre, especially the legend that is Linda at the Stage Door, an institution. Now, one of the things I really love about this podcast is that I'll listen back to episodes and I'll think, my God, I wish when I was a young actor just starting out, I had someone as cool as Papa Essiadu to give me that kind of insight into how to maximise your chances of succeeding, doing the job really well, practical advice. I mean, that extraordinary story about Papa's big break halfway through a production of King Lear, when the actor playing Edmund lost his voice, and Papa, who'd had no rehearsal time of his own, had been to Sam Troughton's rehearsals, the guy who was originally cast as Edmund. He'd watched, he'd listened, he'd learned the lines, he'd done his work, he'd spent a lot of time thinking about it. So when an emergency happened, he could step in and he could be brilliant. And people could go, whoa, not only is he talented, but temperamentally, he's ready. And I just love that. I thought that was really inspiring. So cool. Thank you to my wonderful producer, Ben Backhouse. Thank you to Acast. Thank you to Iggy and Phoebe Cake for the music. And please join me next week, if you can, when I take a magnificently labyrinthine journey into the mind and the heart of one of Britain's most exciting actors, Bertie Carvel. The brilliant Bertie Carvel. Please join me if you can, because Bertie is fascinating. Stay.